So today's first presentation is by the legendary man of Linux audio, Fons Andriansen. You know this person but through his work like Zeta Convolver and Aiolos. And today he's going to be presenting a very exciting topic, real-time audio tools as Python classes. So I think that everybody's very excited. Let's go ahead.
Thank you. So welcome, everybody. It's hot for everybody here, so I want to make it short. So, Jack Tools. What is it? Set of audio processing tools, and each of them is a Jack client, so it will connect to whatever you want. And it's also a Python class, which means you use it from Python. All the actual DSP work is actually done in C++, so it's perfectly real-time safe, all you want. But your interface, the only thing you will ever see is Python. You won't see any C or whatever when you are a user of these things. So, a lot of modules exist at the moment. And most of them I developed as part of my job at Huawei. And unfortunately, I cannot publish all of them because they implement proprietary stuff. But those that can be published will be available, of course. And they fall in two groups. You have tools which will help you to do measurements, audio and acoustics, and tools which are general purpose building blocks for audio systems. So one thing should be clear, this is not a tool to make music or whatever. This is tools for audio engineers in the first place. If you make an installation or something like that, then the second class, so the general purpose audio building blocks, could help you to make something which is robust and which can run by itself and unattended for a long time, for example. But it's not meant to produce content. It's really something to build the infrastructure of your system, not the content. So how did this, or where does this come from? Some years ago, I wanted some method to test DSP algorithms, which means you have to generate signals, send them to your application, which is running in real time, because that's the only real test you can do, capture whatever comes out and analyze it and display it. So first and the third thing can easily be done in Python. And if you use NumPy, so the mathematical extensions of Python, then this sort of thing is really easy. You can generate signals, analyze signals with arbitrary complexity. So that's very nice. But the second part was missing. How do we connect this Python data to something which is running in real time? And the result was this, the first of the Jack tools, which is called Jack Signal. And that's just an application which creates up to 64 inputs or outputs on Jack. And each of them is associated with a NumPy buffer. So samples which go out and in are in NumPy data structures, which means you can generate and analyze them using whatever you have or want to use in Python. It's very, very flexible tool to do measurements because it has basically no limits. You can generate arbitrary signals and do with them whatever you want. So what are the advantages of using this sort of stuff? For measurements and technical use, you have the full power of Python. So all the NumPy extensions, scientific Python, matplotlib for displaying things, and so on, that's all easily available and can be linked to your data in one or two lines, mostly. And you can fully automate tests. In some cases, that's very important. One of the things I do is calibrate multi things like the tetramic or the octamic, so it's microphones which with 8 or even more capsules. And they need to be calibrated, which is quite a complicated process. Lots of measurements, lots of computation. All of this is automated using these sort of tools. And otherwise it would be quite impossible to do because the possibility that you make an error in the process of measuring it is just too high if you don't automate it. Then for general purpose audio things, you can make arbitrary systems. They can be scripted, so just launch a script and everything is set up. You can, using Python, interface to the whole world, really. It's probably the most flexible language that exists. It has thousands of libraries that let you use anything you want from MIDI, OSC, MQTT, everything. You can easily create an ad hoc graphical user interface using tools like BIQT. And the thing is, you can hide or expose complexity of your thing as desired. So you, if you use a standard tool, say Pure Data or Order or whatever, you're always exposing the whole thing. Here you can make an interface which is really ad hoc, start, stop. Yeah. One of the things I'm doing with this is doing listening tests at work, for example, where listeners have to listen to things and they just have to say A is B, A or B is better. But the system itself, which has to be real time, because for example it involves head tracking with the headphone, the system itself can be extremely complex. So with this, if you build it as a set of Python, of Jack tools, it's very easy to make a user interface which is just what you need for that listening test. And also it provides very stable systems which can run unattended. So in Python you do not only start all these things, configure them, you can also monitor them. So if one of them would crash, you could have some Python code which automatically restarts it, for example. So a system, any installation which needs to run for months without anything, without anyone monitoring it, you can make it this way and it will be very dependable. So let's just run through the available models very quickly because it's quite boring. So the first one was the Jack signal thing, and it's meant to measure and test things. Combine it with NumPy and so on. You have up to 64 inputs and outputs. You can actually loop the thing, so you can have the thing generate a waveform and then loop it forever if you want just a sine wave, for example, which continues all the time. You don't need a 10 minutes buffer, just one cycle is enough, in fact. You can do sample accurate measurements with this thing. So if you want to measure latency in your application, it will be sample accurate. And if latency is of no concern, you can even use it to do some DSP experimental things with the DSP code in Python. You just let it run with a large buffer. Every quarter second or so, you look at where it is. So we have a counter of the samples. And whenever we have half a buffer, you take it into Python, do the computations, send it back, and that's it. It works perfectly. It's high latency, but it works. And you don't have to write one line of C to do it. This is a very simple thing. Just generates white and pink noise. Up to 64 outputs, and they are all uncorrelated and independent, which for some measurements is essential. Also very accurate, so its spectrum is within is better than a tenth of a dB. And meter, standard filters to do noise measurements mainly. Again, up to 64 channels. You have all the standard filters available, so if you want to measure a sound card, how good is it, what is the noise figure of the microphone input, this is the sort of thing you would use. And it also provides the filtered signals on the output. Octave and one-third octave band filters. Again, this is something for measurement only. You can have up to 64 filters in one instance of this class. And the filters are class 1 compliant, so the highest quality you can have. One thing we could do, for example, is use Jack signal to test, actually, the filters which are implemented here. We'll just run this as a test. I need to use Python 3 here. So this is a simple application which will use Jack signal and this filter object, and Jack signal is used to measure the filters actually to verify that they are doing what I expect they do. measuring four bands at a time because they don't overlap. Nearly finished. Yep. So, and we have our filters. Next one. Very simple thing. Now we are in the, all the previous ones was measurement and so on. This is general purpose audio. This is just the DSP part of a fader, but a good one. One which doesn't make noises, which doesn't click, and you can control it with a controlled speed. So the speed at which the gain changes can be controlled. It's a parameter in the calls which control this thing. Yeah, fully de-zippered. You will see that on almost all the slides. That's one thing I really wanted in all these classes. They are for professional use, so they won't click, they won't make noises you don't want. You can start them without making noises. When you start them up, they will not produce any signal. They are really silent, and so on, and so on. And okay, K-meter, which is the DSP part of the K-meter, so it measures RMS and peak level. Up to 64 channels again. There's a GUI for this, which is available in the examples. And if you combine, for example, the third octave band filters and this thing and the GUI code, you can, in a few minutes, make something like this. Which is a third octave band analyzer showing RMS and peak. So this is all Python. Next one. Matrix, check matrix, is a signal matrix. So a thing which has up to 64 inputs and outputs. Each output is any combination of any inputs. The sort of thing you need in if you make a very big PA system, for example, with speakers all around, and you have to send different signals to different speakers. You can do this, for example, in order of or on your mixer or whatever. But it's much easier if you can program it and script it. Actually, big PA mixers have this sort of thing built in, usually. The next release will also include delays, which means you can use it to do delay-based panning, for example, in a PA system. Then, mat convolution. Okay, convolution matrix, up to 64 by 64 again. This one is optimized for short convolutions in a complete matrix. It's a thing you would use to do beam following with microphone arrays or with speakers and that sort of stuff. And it is actually multi-threaded, so the work will be divided over as many CPUs as you have. G-convolve, again, convolution matrix. This one is actually built on top of the Zeta Convolver library. So this one is optimized for very long convolutions with zero delay. Sparse matrices, it's actually a Python version of G-Convolver. Parametric EQ, okay. Again, this is multi-channel equalizer. If you have, for example, an ambisonic system, 25 channels, you need an equalizer with 25 identical channels, this thing will do it. You can have up to 8 EQ sections, each can be parametric or a second order shallow filter. And of course it's again fully de-zippered. And anything you don't use in the equalizer, so sections which are at 0 dB are automatically bypassed, so you save some CPU if necessary. This is again something we could show. For example, the shallow filter. We use again Jacques signal to measure it. Sorry. Shallow VQ, let's say 2. So now it's being measured. It's actually running as a Jacques client now and being measured. It will take a few seconds. Okay, that's it. So these are the sort of things you can have with the shell of the high frequency shell of filter. It has a shape control, so it can go from very smooth to steeper. And if you put the shape at maximum, you get this curve, which is famous from very expensive mixing consoles. If you go up, so the shell is positive, it first goes down and then up, which sounds very nice in most cases. So some of the most expensive analog mixers actually had filters like this. And on the right bottom, you see the effect of the shape using the same gain for each. Yes, gain and frequency for each of them. So it really goes from a very smooth filter to a very steep one. And okay, peak limiters. If you know Zeta DPL1, look ahead peak limiter. This is a Pythonized version of this. So you can use this as part of your script, usually at the output, just before the amplifiers of a PA system, for example. Again, up to 64 channels. Jack player, okay, audio file player, multi-channel. We'll do this sampling, so if you load something which is not a file, which is not at your current sampling rate, it's automatically desampled. You have transport control and so on. This will play anything that LibSound file can handle, and up to 64 channels. Then we have some ambisonic stuff. First one, ambisonic panning, up to fourth order, using the MBIC standard, because okay, the FUMA standard is more or less forgotten, I think. Again, fully de-zippered, of course, it's almost on every slide, just like 64. Currently it's single input, so it's just one panner. Next release we'll have multiple inputs and the mixing bus integrated. Actually, I implemented that yesterday afternoon here outside. So if you need it urgently, just ask, and otherwise it will be in the next release. Ambisonic rotation, up to fourth order, on any axis. So you cannot just rotate about the z-axis, the vertical one, which is easy. This can rotate on any axis and do any rotation you want, which is mathematically quite a complex thing, actually. The rotation is defined by a quaternion. You need to know what a quaternion is in order to use it. And again, the rotation itself is again fully de-zippered, so it will not make funny noises when you use it. This, for example, is part of the next one. Ambisonics to binaural rendering. Again, up to fourth order, so this combines the rotation for head tracking. So you use a headphone with a sensor on top of it, and then when the sound is there and you move your head, it stays there. So it combines the rotation, near-field compensation filters, and convolution. So this requires one pre-computed impulse response for each ambisonic component. You can get something for free from the IEM, for example. In Graz, they have published some of the filters which are compatible with this thing. What is missing here is the room simulation, which is actually quite essential if you want to do binaural. You could easily do that using the other tools, the matrix convolution, for example. If you combine it with this, you can also do room simulation at the same time. And then it starts to work really well. So, that's what we have at the moment. What will be added, certainly, is an ambisonic decoder. So MDEC in its Python version, which will be much more flexible. I plan to add Python versions of the network interfaces, so the jack to network interfaces, so you can send data from one computer to another easily. And if you want something special, offer me presents. And then you have a chance of getting it ahead of time. A beer at the next lag counts as a present, so that's okay. Doesn't have to be expensive. 5 minutes, okay. I won't talk much about how this is done technically. If you want to know, there is a bit more in the paper. So how we integrate C and Python. Only thing I will say, okay, we're using Python C API directly. There's no toolset involved, which is one big uncertain dependency less. If you look at Python C API, it looks extremely complicated. Really, you get afraid when you see this. It's thousands of functions, but it's actually easy to use once you understand a few concepts. And the real concepts you need to know if you want to program this sort of thing. As a user, you're not concerned with this. You only see the Python. But if you want to program this, you need to understand the reference counting in Python. You need to know how NumPy's arrays are implemented. Because this is all zero copy. If you pass data from Python NumPy arrays to C, it's not copied. C is just using the Python data structures. You need to understand how multithreading works in Python. And you need to understand Python capsules. Capsules is a simple Python class which actually does nothing but contain a C pointer or a C++ pointer. So you can give a C++ pointer to Python, and Python later can send it back to some C code as a reference. That's how you actually make a class. So the C++ code will generate a capsule which represents the object, give that to Python. When Python needs to access that C++ class, it will just give back that capsule, and then you get back the C pointer. But this, again, as a user, you don't need to know any of this. So, installation. This is all developed on Python 3, but it should work on 2.7, actually. Also, all the interface code which is generated between C++ and Python, it's always done for 3 and 2 at the same time. So it just depends on which Python you are using. You will need some libraries, of course, because it uses a lot of processing stuff behind the scenes. FFTW you need, libsound file, of course. The resample library, the convolver, and Zeta G client is a new library which actually abstracts a Jack application. You can use it in C, but I only wrote it to be used here. But you could, in theory, use it in C++ if you want to make a Jack client in a few lines. So we need to install this first, then the Python parts. You will need NumPy, because all sample data is actually in NumPy arrays. Then you have Zeta Audio Tools, which is just Python classes providing audio file access in an easy way. And then you have the real Zeta Jack tools, which are the Jack applications. And to run the examples, you probably know Skype, don't think you need it, but you certainly need Matplotlib for the sort of thing which I've shown here. NPIQT if you want to make graphical user interfaces. The example code, it's all tested on Python 3. If you run it on 2, you may need some small changes, but normally it should work. Documentation, so all classes have Python docstrings, so you can use Python's built-in help system to get information about them. Have a look at the examples. If that doesn't work, ask on the mailing list. And if that doesn't work, just mail to me. But note, HTML goes into dev0, yes, or dev0. That's it. Thank you.
What's the maximum number of speaker channels you've driven with this system?
Speaker channels? I've not doing very big speaker systems at the lab.
Would you like to?
Oh, yes. at the lab in Huawei, it's 24.
24?
Yes.
Could it be expanded? We have 48.9.
Yeah. All these things, when you're multi-channel, it's always 64. Is the limit, and even that, if you change one line in the C code, you could make it 256 if you wanted.
Excellent.
It's just a constant, which is
defined. Meet me in the alley round the back. I've got a bribe for you.
So no, it is now, there is some classes have a built-in limit of 64, but that's just a compile time constant. So,
is this on?
Yes.
Yep.
Fons, just a quick estimate, how much of the C code, if I
got that right, the cores in C, mm-hmm. and then you interface to Python.
Yep.
So how much of this library is actually interfacing to Python? Would it make sense to, if you wanted to port it to, say, Lua, to take this code and port it over, or would you better starting with the sitalibs directly?
No, you could probably reuse most of them, mm-hmm. because for all of these classes, the actual interface code is a separate file. So usually, for most of the classes, you have one or more classes implementing the DSP, then one which will add the Jack client, and then one which will add the Python interface. In some cases, which are simple, like the gain control, for example, the DSP and the Jack client may be in the same file, for right. example. But the interface to Python is always a separate file. And with one exception, which is the Jack signal thing, the DSP code doesn't see the Python at all. It's called from Python over. But it doesn't need to include Python stuff or whatever. The only exception is Jack signal because it has to use these numpy buffers.
Yeah, thank you for the talk. Thank you for the tools. You mentioned in the beginning that it's not for music making.
No.
Does that include, in your opinion, using it to build tools for music making?
You could do that, okay, of course. Yeah. Yeah. But it's not meant as a tool. You could, in theory, contain or build up a complete mixer with this thing.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah, but that's not what I encourage you to do.
Yeah, of course, I see.
But if you need some special signal routing control for an installation, for example, which is non-standard, then this is a very nice way to do it.
Yeah, so can it run on a humble CPU system like Raspberry Pi or...
Yes.
With low yes. latency?
With low latency.
And 64 channels.
Well, that depends on what you are doing with these 64 channels.
I think it's very interesting to make music.
Actually, the Python does not add any overhead to the DSP code. It's just controlling the DSP code. So the DSP code is as efficient as it would be if you would use the C directly. What you can do on the Raspberry, well, it depends.
For installation-wise, like you said, like... Yeah.
You cannot probably do 64 by 64 matrix of convolutions on a Raspberry.
I was just asking, like...
But all the rest, it's quite efficient. It's written for efficiency. I have a reputation for that.
Hi, Fonsa. So a question about when you're developing the C algorithm, so the actual mm-hmm. DSP part, is that something that you now do by creating a Python class and the interface, and then you start developing the C as a Python module? Or would you use a workflow where you develop the C code
C comes first.
Separately and then port it into this framework, we'll say?
Yep. The C code always, in this case, always came first. Yep. Right.
And do you think that this framework might have value in terms of prototyping DSP in C, kind of using
that? Well, it won't help you to write the C. What this provides is, once you have the C code, it's quite easy to add the Python bindings to it and then use it as a small part of a big system.
Yes.
What this thing does is make it easy to build a system by combining the blocks. It's all Jack and it's all Python. That's what it does.
Anyone else?
Thanks for the presentation and showing off the new tools. I have a question because I noticed, for example, on the mailing list, the way you receive input is always through email.
Preferred, yes, or on the mailing list.
Yeah, is it possible to set up a bug tracker or something so we get more visibility of what's going on behind the scenes?
It would be possible, but it's certainly not on my list of priorities.
Okay. Is what about perhaps making the development open so it's not just released or
well. I'm not really an advocate of this. Depends on what sort of code this is. This is very specialized stuff. And I like to keep in control.
Sharing is caring.
Well, I'm sharing it. As it is.
Anyone else?
Thanks.
Remember, guys, you can buy the proceedings at the bar.
Okay, thank you.
I need to restart with governances.
Okay, everyone. So the next, what they're saying, is this streaming? The stream is on, yeah? Okay, guys. So let's move to the next presentation. It's going to be a presentation by Paul Weaver and David Honor about distributed control of applications. And let's get right to it.
Hello. Ooh, that's loud. Thanks for coming. It's been really interesting being here the last few days. We were here at LAC for the first time last year, and there was lots of interesting things, and so we thought we should sort of introduce ourselves and share what we've been kind of working on over the last sort of year or so, which is a thing called CLAPI, the Concert Lightweight API Framework, which is all about sort of distributed control of stuff. The lightweight is in scare quotes because we started wanting to make something really light and breezy and just a sort of extra layer on top of OSC, and it got more involved. So what I want to talk about today is kind of who we are, where we've come from, why we're building an API framework in the first place, and what Clappy ended up being, and kind of what you can do with it. And hopefully at the end we'll have a bit of an interactive demo so that we can show like what we're kind of aiming towards.
By interactive, we mean you.
So we started this thing. We had to give it a name because we were talking to people about it quite a lot, called Concert, which came out of the idea that Dave and I are both Python developers, mainly is what we've done in the past together. And we really like working with each other online. So we're used to development workflow with Git and version control, seeing what everyone's doing and commenting on threads and things. And we are used to collaborating on code together on a single session. So I'll fire up a Tmux session where Dave can come and connect, and we can like comment on code and make changes and suggest things in a really sort of fluid way. And we didn't come across anything like this for audio. And we were sort of toying around with the idea of, why can't audio be version controlled in Git? Why can't we manage to find things where we can collaborate on sessions remotely? So we're trying to build a collaborative kind of collaborative audio production tools with a kind of soft real-time interactive element and a sort of asynchronous workflow management as well, that's all part of the same kind of data model. That's the grand lofty goal. This kind of sketch is the bit that we're talking about today, which is a lot less grand sounding. Basically, we're going to have some kind of API provider that is doing some audio processing and presenting an API. And we've got some devices that effectively the goal is that they could be anything. So it's kind of a heterogeneous mix of stuff that can connect. And the bits we've been working on are really the these communication channels, the lines between these components, and the bit in the middle that's sort of the hub where everyone connects to, and kind of the architecture of that. Was there anything else more on this one that we want to talk about? Cool. Just to give you a bit of idea about the languages we've been writing, the audio processing in the provider is written in C, and then we've ended up in Haskell. So some of the application layer of that is written in Haskell. The relay is exclusively in Haskell, and then the UIs we're looking at are going to be written in sort of JavaScript that's come from Elm. So there's a mixture of languages going on here. Quite a lot of stuff we've experimented with. Dave's just choking to death. Right. Okay, so we had a long list of requirements for stuff as we were thinking about our API. Event-driven was obviously a big requirement. We wanted to be able to push out things that were happening as they were happening, rather than having to do sort of big, chunky data updates with request-response. And because we've got a heterogeneous mix of clients where your phone might have play pause buttons on it, but your 4K display might have an entire door application on it, we want to be able to do subscriptions so that the phone doesn't get every single thing that's going on in the whole ecosystem, because it doesn't need them, it'll throw them all away, whereas the desktop needs to be able to update with everything. Validation, introspection, and dynamic schema all kind of come as one lump. We want to be able to check that the messages that clients and providers are sending are legitimate, so they are what they should be, and that there's some kind of way of knowing in advance what the messages over the protocol are going to be. That will come in a lot later when we have a look at the user interface, but like most of our user interface can just be generated by introspecting the API schema rather than having to code a static user interface. The idea of this being that, as Mark was really explaining really nicely yesterday in his talk about RTOSC, you're keeping your data with the thing that is actually talking about it and generating it, and everything else is sort of subservient to that idea. And we need dynamic schema because we're hoping to be able to host plugins that will be able to provide what their data types are, and we want to be able to find all of that stuff out as we go dynamically, rather than having to again communicate bits of UI and things and keep them all in sync.
Effectively, that's a case of, we don't know our schema up front. We can't just produce like a soap style WSDL that contains all the things a plugin might ever do. That's just not viable, so we have to take a slightly different approach.
Yes. Other things to do with sort of our collaboration model. We are in a domain where we want to talk about time series data. We've kind of got our project time space as well as what people are doing right now in the real world and mapping those two together. And we kind of wanted, well, as we were exploring the APIs, we were trying to think of a way of talking about these as sort of first-class citizens in our data model. We want to track attribution of everything, which is something that we hadn't really come across in many APIs at all. You've got this collection of clients all talking, but they're different people, potentially, and so we want to know who changed what when, because if you're in an environment where people are doing things underneath you, hey, Dave, stop fiddling with that EQ that I was fiddling with, that, you know, kind of thing, problem. We will get onto a bit about caching, and we want to be able, because we've got all the schemas and the introspection and everything, we want to be able to make sure that we're consistent, so we never get to a state where, you know, we don't quite know what's going on or we're half updated. So that's quite a long list of high-level constraints. And this sounds like a shopping list that we went in with, but really we found it really hard to write this talk because we only discovered some of these when we're halfway through and go, of course, I just need to know who clicked on this button and the person who did it is like miles away from what we're doing. So we definitely started off by looking at other things that existed. So we both work in a domain where we're doing things with lots of APIs in our day jobs, we were, and we deal with network protocols a lot. So OSC is the canonical kind of audio API that everyone, or audio API kind of framework that everyone's been talking about over this weekend, and it's really good. It's event-driven and it's really simple to understand, and that was great for us. The downside that we saw was that it was sort of unidirectional and specifically really oriented to UDP, and we've got very session-oriented connections going on. So we'll come on to some of that in a minute. HTTP is fab from my point of view. I've done loads of HTTP API work. We've done XML RPC, we've done things with SOAP, we've done things with REST and all kinds of frameworks there. And there's a rich set of established semantics over that and content negotiation, all sorts of things. And the web generally is actually very well designed in that way. But it's very request response heavy. You've got definite server, definite client, and stuff doesn't really just happen. And everything that comes on top of that, like dynamic in web pages, is all kind of an additional layer or two of things going on.
Yeah, so if, for instance, if you define something with WebSockets, which would be a way to get away from the request response, you're basically defining yourself another protocol anyway. It doesn't really buy you as much as it would if you were speaking standard request response HTTP.
And then for some of the responsive systems we developed when we were working at Cisco, we had subscription models in AMQP, for example, but then those that broker kind of pub-sub thing is just about method dispatch and getting your data to where it wants to go, and you can't inject into the broker anything about like what the content of the message is because they're designed to be very big scales worth of data and just very fast dispatch, so they don't blend well to that. So we had a naive plan. We were going to start with OSC in PyLibLO because we were writing Python to rapidly prototype some stuff. We just picked some features from the other paradigms that we liked and kind of have some lightweight conventions that we put on top of OSC, and it would all be great.
And that was horrendous. We had some of the things that are really good in normal OSC turn out to be really problematic for us. So, for instance, the bundle semantics. In OSC, they're about all these things happen simultaneously. For us, we have an idea of like an atomic commit across paths in the tree. If you try and abuse the OSC one for that, you run into all sorts of weird edge cases because you can send stuff not in a bundle. The bundle has a time that doesn't really mean anything. You can nest the bundles, and what does that mean for your transactions? And it all gets very gnarly in a way that's totally understandable because we're trying to abuse it. We also found we needed some extra bits, like we had some functions that didn't take, like, their parameters weren't ints. They took a list of ints as a parameter. And that's something that isn't in the standard OSC, so you have to add a convention for that. And we needed, as we said before, we're talking about these time series. How do you do that? Well, you could sort of put it in the path, but then you're putting like an NTP timestamp in the path, and that's kind of horrible. Or you put it as a first argument, and then it doesn't really work very well like that either. So that all got very tricky, and we also were trying to do something kind of restful in the sense that our paths represented a particular piece of data rather than a method call. And so that was also a little tricky. So we ended up defining, when we were in OSC, another layer on top of OSC that translated what we had. It kind of serialized we meant
to
into OSC, which we then serialized. So when we switched to Haskell and there wasn't an established OSC library for it, we sort of thought it would be easier to not get involved in the translating to translate. We have kept a lot of the flavor of OSC in our serialization format, but the serialization format of many things is not really the tricky bit.
Yep.
At least for us as protocols people, it seemed like writing a parser was not too horrendous.
So we switched to Haskell because when we were prototyping in Python, there were a lot of complicated ideas that all lent on each other, and testing it and keeping it up to date as we were changing our ideas for everything was really hard. And Haskell, I have found to be quite good. Someone lent me a book. I've only been developing Haskell for about 2 years, but someone lent me a book and said, you'll probably like this and the way you think. And yeah, it basically now tells me wherever I've made a mistake, and I like that because I can't track things in my head. I'm very forgetful. So what finally we get to what Clappy is. We've basically built a TCP-based sort of session-oriented protocol, and with a broker in the middle, which was that relay thing we looked at. It's trying to represent, as Dave said, a tree of typed data, so as resources that you can subscribe to as they change over time. And we can always verify the types of those. We have an in-memory cache, so unlike something like AMQP, where you can subscribe to a channel, but you only get messages that occurred after you subscribed, we will know what the last state of every resource was, so that when you subscribe, you get told what the current state is, and then you get all the updates as they come. We validate all the messages in atomically applied blocks, so we have things like cross-references in our API. So if you cross-reference a path that's gone away in your collection of messages, it'll say, well, hang on a minute, like that's not valid anymore, you need to sort it out. So it's a little bit databasey we got into in some senses, yeah. And that was bad. And then, yeah, we have these two roles. So the things I drew on the left before, which were the providers, they have a different set of things they can say to the clients. But a single connection, as when you're connected on a single connection, you can act as both roles. You can only say certain things about certain things. The API providers, they occupy like a top-level namespace within the tree. So we have a couple in the example we're going to show you today. We have like the API that tells you about the API, sort of meta API. We have the relay, which is the API for the actual broker component itself. And we have the engine, which is sort of our the audio engine that's actually doing the processing's API. And each provider will publish a collection of types that says, here are all the things I can talk about. And it will say, here's the data that conforms to all the things I can talk about. And crucially, when it's publishing data, it just publishes on the one stream and says, that happened, go figure. And it doesn't matter if no one's connected or if like 20 people are connected, they all just get the same broadcast. And they just receive updates as a single sort of serialized stream of requests. So they're not having to juggle whoever might be connected, which is especially important because we're trying to keep the network overhead on the audio processing component, like or the machine doing the audio processing, really low. The API clients have a simpler job. They subscribe to the types and the data, and they get pushed updates for the things they're interested in, and then they can flip that around and say, oh, change that value to 3 or whatever. So this is kind of pseudocode for what our API represents. This is the sort of simplest API that we provide in our relay. So at the top, I will use my mouse because that will be easier. At the top, this type here, this is type land in the top pane. We say that the API namespace is a structure that has one member that is called version. It's of this type, API's namespace and the version type, and it's read-only. So then we can look at what the version type is, and we just see that it's a pair of unsigned 32-bit integers. Okay, fair enough. And then in the sort of value space, as opposed to the type space, we just say that the path slash API slash version has this pair of values 0, 0, and 1. Then we can move on to something a little bit more sort of fully fledged and rich. This is the API that we're going to demo the UI for in a minute.
There's more.
Yeah, there's more stuff. We'll break it down because it is a little bit sort of overbearing when you first look at it. So the engine namespace, the namespace for the provider who's going to do the audio processing for us, has, amongst other things, a transport member, which has this type, and you're not allowed to change the contents of the container. So we've got a lot of stuff around containers. And just sort of flipping through this, basically, information about editability and read-onlyness, we can get down to the three data members that we care about. The sort of state of the transport, which has kind of got this rich type. I'm an enumeration of stopped and rolling, and a couple of things which do with time, so the cue point and the time at which we last changed play state. And here you can see the transport state in this current example is in zero, so we know the transport is stopped, and we can pull out those semantics and put it in the UI. And then we know where the cue point is, and we know when everything was last changed. So that's it. I'm probably going to skip time series data. We can come back to that if people are interested. And now it's time for some demo.
Yes. Okay. So the demo, we actually explain what's going on here. The thing we drew up earlier, where we had all the API providers and bits and bobs, the majority of the components are currently running on this laptop. So we've got the audio engine, which is currently set to change a gain of nothing to nothing, because we're talking about semantics and not anything else, so we haven't bothered saying anything very fancy. That is connecting out through all the components we described. So there's a relay running here, and then there's for some UI. Yeah, here we go.
I'm going to turn around. Yeah, we want to, in a minute, hang on, I'm just trying to. So the network here is a bit strange. I think it's partitioned. So if you've got a 172 address here, you should be able to connect to the UI.
Yes.
I'm going to open up another terminal. I haven't got enough space on this screen, and I can't see where my mouse has gone.
Right.
There we go. Found it.
You found it. Cool. So what will eventually appear once we've managed to get it to play nicely on the connecting?
There we go.
That's more like it. This is the super, super, super simple
prototypical
UI. So this is ugly. Things move around underneath you. It's a piece of HTML that's connecting via a WebSocket, because, yes, we did have to do WebSockets in the end. We've got a bridge that talks JSON WebSockets to this thing, but it's just a translation. So this is our lump of elm, and if you were to, you can't see my thing, but so I can move stuff around on this and it'll move around on there.
Yeah, so Dave has a copy of this UI on his screen, and he's just moved the cue point for me. If I open up a new window in Firefox and I go to the same address, we'll see that I get a copy of the UI. And you can see that here, so the red and green highlighting are when things change. What's happened there, Dave?
Something unhappy has happened
Has happened there, Dave.
Good old demo effect.
It is the demo effect. We checked this an hour ago, and it was working.
All right, so if you refresh it now, it'll be fine.
Ah, good, okay. There we go.
So that's to do with I started trying to add extra stuff to one of the components, and I seem to have broken it in some way.
So the thing we've got here is that we've got independent user interfaces. So the one on the bottom, I've just changed the zoom in, and that's local to the web browser, but the cue point is moving in all of them, and I can see brilliantly that you're all clicking things, and we're seeing things change. So at the bottom, this stuff is sort of a debug diagnostic data where we could just see who's connected. So,
And you can show the time difference between the clocks of the people who are connected and the relay. So at the moment, it's showing us in this one, what have you got up there? You haven't got enough height.
I can give you more height.
You've got open, the relay is highlighted up there, and so is some random thing that's been clicked on.
This is a person.
This is some person. So you can tell that you are 81, your clock is 81 seconds out with that of the relay. This all seems really weird.
Yeah.
Until, and probably so did the thing about us giving you the time when the last transport change happened. This all ties together, because what you get when you start rolling is we can get the playhead state and where it's moving without having to send any update messages to you about where that is, for the purposes of the UI anyway. Okay. Fun. Ah, transport SQL rolling not implemented. Yeah, thanks for that.
This is what happens when we touch our, everyone is sort of touching our everything. But you get the flavor. So we were showing there that we were seeing subscriptions to people's clock offsets, but only when I was interested in knowing what my clock offset was. So the green and the red were like new bits of data coming into the API and going away. We had the queue point moving with everybody. We had the transport state rolling with everyone, et cetera. Oh, okay. Wait. There we go.
So. Yes, not implemented features will get
anyway,
right now.
So that's our demo. Just very quickly in conclusion, if I can find the right page. My laptop doesn't like the screen. There we go. So we found that whilst we knew API design was hard, API meta design was really, really hard. Refactoring in Python, even though we both really were comfortable with Python and really liked it, became a burden as our code base got really complicated. We achieved our long list of requirements, which I realized when I was writing them down that I was quite pleased that I managed to do that. And that Introspection is actually really powerful because most of that UI is completely dynamically generated.
The UI that you see there is one that if there's a switcheroo button at the top which you can press, which will let you just put paths in, and it doesn't know any more than this is the path I'm trying to show you. That's all it knows. So everything else is just generated.
Cool. So we got some more stuff we want to add, and you can find all the code on github.com/concert, and we're sort of concert.co.uk if you want to find out about us. Thank you very much.
Questions?
Hi, thank you for the presentation. And the concert is really meant for live performances. Like you have a shared transport, and you couldn't do like independent editing. Like you're in one room listening to one with one transport, and you're in another room.
This bit of it is for that. Eventually, we want to, within a given situation, yeah, it's for the bit we're showing today is for I've got my phone and my computer, I'm going into the studio a bit and I don't want to keep bothering the guy in the control room with this. Eventually we want to use one set of this whole thing as a client to another to allow partial synchronization as desired. But that is not there at all.
So far it's basically mostly remote control of
yes. Yes.
And the API is serializable to a form where you can git diff it. So if you've taken a snapshot of the API and another snapshot of the API, the one of the constraints is that you can then merge them, and only merge conflicts are like decisions you have to make.
Hi, yes. Good stuff. I have two questions for you.
Yes.
First one is, part of what you did very looks like protobuf or Thrith. Any reason why you didn't use those existing technologies?
We looked briefly. I've looked at protobuf before. Mostly, the prototype is still kind of a prototype, as you can tell. It's written in Haskell. Is the serialization isn't our main problem. It's working out what each member is allowed to say and how they're allowed to say it. So, for example, the time series that I was going to put up, we have to uniquely identify each time point with an identifier so that if one person comes in and moves a time point in time and someone else wants to change the value, you know exactly what edits people are trying to make. So it's that kind of semantic level thing we're doing. And basically, as Dave said, when we were serializing our stuff to OSC, you could put OSC, you could put protobuf, you could probably put any kind of serialization format underneath you like. So absolutely, you know, we've done it. The website that we were looking at was talking in JSON because it was easier to get JSON across a WebSocket than it was to get binary.
And the second one, why did you find refactoring in Python complicated, and why is Haskell better?
I think it was mostly because the particular domain we're in here was extremely type-centric. So a lot of the things we're describing are
The data types tend to flow through your code. So if you make a small change to something fundamental, everywhere you've used it, you have to change what you've done. And there's no way in Python you can see what you've used because all of the things like Flake 8 or Pylint that look at your code have to cope with the fact that Python could have changed anything underneath you, so it can't make strong guarantees. In contrast, because Haskell follows everything through your code base, you can find things that are distant, and it will still say, you made a mistake here, it's not that thing. So it was mostly that.
I think, yeah, because I've been thinking about it while you were talking. It's because we have a lot of things that are, the data type defines what it is, not its behavior, in a sense. And I think if you had something where it was a lot about behaviors, then it would be a different balance, potentially. Mm.
Yeah. Hi. Thanks Hello. A lot. It's maybe unrelated, but there is a lot of synchronization going on in this system. And I'm not a developer, like, in the proper sense of it, but I played with Tone.js and triggering audio synthesis from my machine to all the clients and all this. So I try to synchronize clients in a network to make more synchronized musical possible, but I only get to compile Ableton Link for Node.js. Someone made a port of it. Do you have any hints on that synchronization issue?
We're not really in the same... Whilst we have a thing that allows you to see where your transport is, it's only really UI-centric. It's not sending the broadcast. It's not doing the auto-discovery. So it's not the same at all as Ableton Link, really.
Yes, so our model is to try and remove as much synchronization requirement as possible so that you get an impression of what someone's doing, but you don't know exactly when it is, because as soon as you go across the internet, really with our thing, you're not needing to get the audio exactly.
And at some point we want to be able to do streams that are synced up to like wall clock time, but you're recording in sections of things. And when we hit that, there'll be a different... Our model is sort of different. We don't synchronize them explicitly. We stream to a buffer, and then we know when it was in session time for them, and we can realign it at any later point.
Okay, guys, I know there are still questions, but please approach Paul and David after the presentation because we're out of time. So thank you, guys. Thanks for the presentation.
Thank you.
I forgot about that implemented back then. That's what was going on.